I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a landmark decision today, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld Americans' right to own guns for self-defense. In a highly anticipated ruling, the High Court struck down the strictest gun control law in the nation. In a 5-4 decision, the justices ruled that Washington, D.C.'s 32-year-old ban on handguns violates the Second Amendment. This is the first time the court has definitively ruled on the meaning of the Second Amendment, which states a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. We're going to hear from a variety of people on the significance of this major ruling over the next half hour, starting with Here and Now Supreme Court watcher Lyle Denniston of SCOTUSblog.com. And Lyle, welcome.
Glad to be with you, Anthony.
The main issue here was the wording of the Second Amendment and whether the framers meant to protect an individual's right to bear arms or the collective right. Justice Antonin Scalia wrote the majority opinion. How did he address the issue?
Well, relying both on the words of the amendment as written in 1791 and on English and American history going back to the 17th century and on state laws in effect at the time of the founding of our country, Scalia opted for an individual right to have a gun. The ruling, however, is narrow only in the sense that it limits that right to having a gun in one's home for self-defense. That was the only issue in the case, and the court has pretty explicitly confined its ruling that the right exists only in that specific setting.
Now, Justice John Paul Stevens wrote the dissent. He was joined by Justices Stephen Breyer, David Souter, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And Stevens wrote that this was not an issue of collective versus individual rights, but what the right to bear arms protects. For example, he wrote, "The Second Amendment plainly does not protect the right to use a gun to rob a bank. It is equally clear that it does encompass the right to use weapons for certain military purposes." Was he saying that you can only have a gun in the course of military service?
Well, he was only saying the Second Amendment guarantees that right. In other words, Stevens and Justice Breyer, who wrote a separate dissent, both of them argued that what is at issue in this case is what the Second Amendment means, and the fact that something, in their view, is not protected by the Second Amendment doesn't mean that you are not going to be allowed to do it. In other words, the Second Amendment clearly does not prohibit anybody from using a gun during a hunting expedition of the kind that Justice Scalia now and then likes to take. So the dissenters were focusing on what the amendment means, and they read it considerably more narrowly than the majority did.
I see. Now, the last time the Supreme Court ruled on the right to bear arms was in 1939. Then the justices upheld a federal ban on sawed-off shotguns and implied that the amendment was set up to protect state militias. So is this ruling in direct contradiction to that 1939 ruling?
This ruling finally clears up, at least for the purposes of the majority's view, that the 1939 decision was not a definitive ruling on that question. There has been a debate almost since the time of the Miller decision in 1939 over what it meant, because it's a fairly crisp and short and to-the-point opinion. But whatever lingering assumption there may be in the body politic that the court had previously guaranteed a right only to have a gun as part of a National Guard or a state militia was cleared up today, and it's clear that this court, the majority now, does not read the 1939 decision as being foreclosing today's decision at all.
Well, thanks very much. That's Lyle Denniston of SCOTUSblog.com. Joining us next is Robert Levy. He's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, the libertarian think tank in Washington, D.C. And Mr. Levy, welcome.
Thanks very much. Nice to be with you.
Well, good day for you. This is your case. You financed the original lawsuit against the D.C. handgun ban. You recruited the plaintiffs. You must be pleased. What's your reaction?
I'm very pleased. The majority, 5 members of the Supreme Court, and of course 5 is all we need, adopted many, I'd say most of the arguments that we put forward in our briefs, and it means now that residents of Washington, D.C. are going to be able to defend themselves in their own homes. D.C. law had precluded all functional firearms in all homes for all people for all purposes, And that has now been declared unconstitutional. I think that's a great day for civil rights.
And, you know, this is being cast as a major decision that really takes a whack at defining exactly what that Second Amendment means, defining, a collective right versus an individual right. Do you see it that way? Is it that sweeping? Is it that big?
It is that big. The court unequivocally said that the Second Amendment secures an individual right, and it's not limited to exercise in the context of militia service. It codifies, among other things, the right to defend yourself, the right to provide food for your family by hunting. So while the militia purpose of the Second Amendment was certainly an important purpose, it was not the only purpose, and the court was quite clear about it, and the court now has put itself on the same side as law scholars across the ideological spectrum, including lots of people on the left who now have come to recognize that the Second Amendment right does indeed secure an individual.
Right. Well, when you spoke to our program a few months ago, you said that you do support some gun regulations, including bans on certain people possessing guns. Do you think this ruling in any way could undermine any of those laws that, you yourself might support?
Well, it will undermine some laws and not undermine others. Justice Scalia was quite clear in his opinion, which I must say I haven't read entirely. It's 150-some pages. He was quite clear in his opinion that certainly regulations that keep guns away from kids and keep guns away from violent felons and keep guns away from the mentally incompetent, those laws are not going to be overturned. They are perfectly permissible. Rights that are set out in the Bill of Rights are not absolute. There are all sorts of restrictions on free speech, even though the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law. There are lots of laws. And the Second Amendment is no exception. So there will be a number of laws that will be upheld by the courts, but there will be some others that just cross over the line. And, of course, the D.C. gun ban is one of those that quite clearly crosses the line.
Well, Robert Levy, thank you so much for joining us today. And, again, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
That's Robert Levy at the Cato Institute. This was very much his case. He financed the original lawsuit against the D.C. handgun ban, which was overturned today. We're going to turn next to John Lowy, senior attorney at the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence in Washington, D.C. And, John, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Anthony.
Let me get your reaction right off the bat. I guess not a great day for you guys. How do you react to this decision?
Well, we think that as a constitutional matter, the five justices got it wrong and the four justices in the dissent got it right. But as a practical matter, this is not that bad a thing, and in some ways actually presents a great opportunity for gun control. Well, one thing that all nine justices agreed on is that a wide variety of gun laws are presumptively constitutional. And Justice Scalia went out of his way in a rather extraordinary fashion to list some of those laws, bans on concealed carry, bans on military-style assault weapons, bans on guns in schools and other sensitive places.
You're referring to this, John. For example, he wrote, the court's opinion should not be taken to cast doubt on longstanding prohibition on the possession of firearms by felons, by the mentally ill, or laws forbidding the carrying of firearms in sensitive places such as schools and government buildings. So you don't see this as necessarily as sweeping and undermining other laws that are on the books.
Precisely. The D.C. law was very unique. So, I mean, it has a limited effect, but additionally, there's an unintended consequence that I think the gun lobby and some of the people who supported this lawsuit will be very unhappy with, and that is that this decision takes the slippery slope argument, which is one of the gun lobby's major arguments against gun laws, off the table. That is, the gun lobby likes to argue that even if a gun law, such as a ban on assault weapons, appears reasonable, people should oppose it because it could lead ultimately to a ban on all guns. Hmm. That's their favorite argument. That argument has been taken off the table because the Supreme Court has said that can't happen. And once that extreme is taken off the table, you have to look at gun proposals on their merits. And the vast majority of Americans, including gun owners, support the agenda that the Brady Center supports. Background checks for all gun sales, bans on assault weapons and such things.
All right. Well, John Lowy, thank you so much for joining us today and giving us your reaction to what is clearly very important decision from the Supreme Court. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's John Lowy, senior attorney for the Legal Action Project at the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence. That's based in Washington, D.C. We want to take a look at what this ruling means for other gun laws in the country and the impact of this ruling beyond that. For that, we turn to Jonathan Turley, George Washington University law professor. And welcome, Jonathan.
Thank you very much.
Give me your first reaction to this. Obviously, a major win here for advocates of gun rights.
It is. You know, this is a historic opinion, and I think there has been today an effort by the other side to basically play down its impact, but it is a very important decision. It's not likely to be another case that we'll see in our lifetime where a major individual right is recognized in the Bill of Rights. Now, some people may call it a new right. Others say it existed and it was just not recognized. But the fact is that this is extraordinary. You know, this was sort of the land that time forgot in the Constitution, that somewhere between the First and Third Amendments, there was this collection of words that the Supreme Court avoided for 127 years since the last time it really addressed it in the Miller decision.
And remind us what that was. Remind us what that Miller decision was.
Well, the decision itself it sort of left open the question of whether we had an individual or collective right. Different people portrayed it different ways. And the problem with the Second Amendment is that it was poorly crafted. You've got two clauses, one that refers to the militia and one refers to the right of gun ownership. And, you know, even though I'm liberal and libertarian, I've long taken the view that the natural reading of that amendment is clearly that of an individual right. And part of the problem here for liberals and libertarians is it's very hard to look at the Bill of Rights and adopt a broad and robust interpretation of all amendments except for the Second Amendment. And I guess I'm sort of an old-fashioned liberal in that sense, in that I celebrate whenever an individual right is found in the Bill of Rights. I hope that gun owners will be as vigorous in defending the Fourth and Fifth and Sixth and Eighth Amendments, which are under attack. But I do believe that it's a good thing when individuals are found to have rights in the Bill of Rights. But when you talk about the potential for this, I think there has been a lot of overplaying. Where I think this decision is legitimately treated as historic, it does not mean that this is going to trigger the Wild West in the streets of D.C. or other cities. The Supreme Court here, the majority, and the lower D.C. Circuit both said that reasonable limitations can be placed on this right. There aren't any absolute rights in the Bill of Rights.
Hmm. Jonathan Turley, stick with us. We're going to continue our conversation after a short break about the significance of this decision today. We're speaking right now with Jonathan Turley, law professor at George Washington University, about today's Supreme Court decision that overturned Washington, D.C.'s 32-year-old ban on handguns. When we come back, we'll talk more about that decision, and we'll take a look at the court's other decisions this session. Back in a minute. Stick with us. It's Here and Now. And we're back now with Jonathan Turley of George Washington University. We're talking today about the Supreme Court's landmark decision striking down the Washington, D.C. ban on handguns, a major decision upholding the individual right to bear arms as described and debated for years in the Second Amendment. And Jonathan, I'm very curious about this question. Why has it taken so long for the Supreme Court to take on this question that clearly has been at the center of so much fiery debate for so long?
That's a very very good question. With the Miller decision, the court dealt with the issue not very clearly. It dealt with the National Firearms Act. And both sides had different interpretations of the ruling. Certainly gun control advocates believed that it gave them an opening to say that it was a collective right. But, you know, the Supreme Court has a history of avoiding difficult questions that are still dividing the circuits. And I think what you had here was a colossal blunder, quite frankly, by the mayor of the District of Columbia and his attorney general, Mr. Nichols, that many of us wrote columns and blogged on how taking an appeal of this case would be a disaster because for gun control advocates. This court clearly was going to support the D.C. Circuit, and I don't know of any one of us who cover the Supreme Court that didn't immediately say that this would be a 5-4 decision to uphold the lower court decision. And so the question then was, why did they do it? Because you then expanded the loss across the country. And the answer is politics, that the mayor and the attorney general felt that the public expected them to do something, even though that something meant that it would forever close the door to arguing a collective right, certainly not until the Supreme Court changes very significantly.
Sure. Jonathan, literally we have 10 seconds left, but very quickly, does this put at jeopardy other gun control laws across the country in your view?
It does to the in the sense that there are prohibitions on gun ownership, and those are going to be very hard to maintain. And I think you're going to find the next few years the court allowing the circuits to find some happy resting place, some balancing point between this new or recognized individual right and reasonable limitations that might be placed on it.
All right. Jonathan Turley, thanks so much for joining us today.
My great pleasure.
That's Jonathan Turley, a law professor at George Washington University, talking to us today about the Supreme Court rejecting, overturning Washington, D.C.'s handgun ban. A day before an internationally condemned runoff election is scheduled to take place in Zimbabwe, the situation in that country appears increasingly desperate. Backers of the current president, Robert Mugabe, were photographed earlier this week using sticks and lead pipes to beat supporters of opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai. Because of the increasing violence, Tsvangirai has pulled out of the election and taken refuge in the Dutch embassy in Harare. Meanwhile, there are reports from all over the country of people desperately fleeing the political violence, looking for food, shelter, and protection. We're joined now by Jerry Jackson, station manager of SW Radio Africa. That's a shortwave radio service based in London, run by journalists from Zimbabwe. Jackson is a Briton who was raised in Zimbabwe and started the station in 2001. And Jerry, your team of journalists is in touch with the latest news from Zimbabwe. What are you hearing?
The level of violence is profound. It's worse than it's ever been, and I don't think most people understand the extent of it because so much of it is happening in rural areas and there are no pictures coming out. Mugabe has made sure they don't. So the reports we've had are that at least 85 MDC officials have been assassinated since the March elections.
MDC officials being opposition party officials.
Correct. Right. There are at least 10,000 people severely injured and beaten, at least 250,000 internally displaced.
A quarter of a million internally displaced. This is a huge humanitarian issue that's developing there.
It is. It's so extensive. I mean, we've had a report from one suburb outside the capital, Harare, where over a five-week period, the state-sponsored youth militia have gone house to house, and they have beaten every single person in the area. We're talking about being beaten all day. Your child removed from your back, your baby removed from your back and thrown in the dirt, and the children watching their parents be brutalized, raped, tortured all day.
Now, yesterday in London, where you are, the former South African president, Nelson Mandela, spoke out against Mugabe, talking about a tragic failure of leadership in Zimbabwe. Mugabe's information minister today dismissed that criticism, saying Mandela was bowing to Western pressure. But do you think that Mandela's involvement, such as it is at this point, can help?
Everyone was hoping for Mandela to say something, and we were all incredibly disappointed that up until now he said nothing, and then he issues this unbelievably careful and watered-down statement. So whether it will do anything, I doubt it. I mean, Mugabe bows to no pressure. He doesn't listen to anybody, although we have just heard, and we're trying to follow it up, that he is saying that he's ready to talk to the MDC. Now, Zimbabwe is full of rumors because it's so hard to get credible and correct information and because it's clamped down on the media. But we know the regime is under severe pressure and there's huge infighting and they don't trust each other now.
Mm. But it does seem that Mugabe's government is determined that elections will go forward tomorrow or some kind of voting, even though there's effectively no opposition candidate. What does this do to the situation and hopes of some kind of progress on the ground there?
It just confirms that we're in a completely joke situation at the moment. Mugabe will declare himself president. No one on the planet will accept that as a credible result. And where do we go from here? I really don't know.
Well, Jerry Jackson, thank you so much for talking to us today about this.
Pleasure. Thank you.
That's Jerry Jackson, station manager of SW Radio Africa, a shortwave radio service based in London. Tomorrow on Here and Now, a real summertime page-turner. Author Lee Montville tells the story of golf, Hollywood, and armed robbery, the true story of the mysterious Montague, who may be the greatest golfer you never heard of. That's tomorrow on Here and Now. Former Democratic rivals Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama will campaign together at a rally in Unity, New Hampshire tomorrow. Unity. Get it? It will be the first joint rally for Obama and Clinton since the end of their long, bruising primary fight. Beyond the obvious symbolism of its name, Democrats chose Unity, New Hampshire for the rally because during the primary, the town gave Obama and Clinton exactly 107 votes each. But behind this public display of unity in unity, there are complex negotiations between the two camps over a series of thorny issues, including Clinton's campaign debt, her role at the Democratic Convention, and what to do with her husband, Bill Clinton. Jeff Zeleny, political correspondent for The New York Times, wrote about this in today's edition of the paper and joins us now. And Jeff, welcome.
Thank you.
Before we get to some of the specifics, there had been concerns that this would just be way too bitter for these two folks to come together. But what I take from your reporting is that efforts to bring Obama and Clinton together are going pretty smoothly.
Well, they seem to be going fairly smoothly, at least from the point of view of the two principals. Senator Obama and Senator Clinton have met privately one time right before she actually dropped out and endorsed his candidacy. And they've spoken on the phone, both of their aides say, a couple times. And, you know, look, they're both political professionals. They're both pros at this, and they certainly have intense feelings. But it is in each of their interests individually and collectively to move forward together. It's slightly more difficult for some of their supporters, particularly some of the supporters of Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton.
ABC's Rick Klein wrote today on The Note. He points out the Clintons have done three crucial things that the Obama camp probably appreciates, including a gracious exit. She's introduced him to some of her top donors, and in particular, she sort of disappeared from the stage for the last few weeks. The Obama people should probably appreciate all of that, right?
I think that they've been treating this as a situation where Senator Clinton will do this in her own time. And no one really from the Obama campaign had any doubt that she would not leave gracefully. You know, again, she is a political professional. She would have had no interest in staying in the race longer than it was going on. So I don't think they're surprised by this. I think, you know, things are very much moving forward. But some of the smaller details, particularly around the Democratic National Convention, those things are still being debated, and I think that is a time when some wounds may open up if they're not already healed.
Well, let's talk about some of those specifics. You mentioned her role at the convention. What's being talked about? What's at stake there?
Well, one thing that's being discussed is what night of the convention will Senator Clinton be allowed to speak? Now, she's had a spot on the convention floor in previous conventions, obviously, and of course she will at this convention, and the Obama campaign is absolutely fine with that. But what speech will it be? You know, it's a pretty crowded slot. You know, on the final day of the convention, Senator Obama will accept the nomination. On the second-to-last day of the convention, it's typically the vice presidential candidate. Will that be her slot? Will it not be her slot? You know, so they're discussing if she'll be in prime time, probably. But one of the other things is, will her name be called out on the roll? And will her pledged delegates have the opportunity to formally cast their votes as delegates for her. A lot of this is window dressing. I think she has said she'll do whatever it takes to move forward and get Democrats elected in November.
I gather one of the other issues that they're negotiating is Hillary Clinton's $22 million campaign debt and what the Obama campaign can do to help her with that. How's that being talked about?
Some Clinton fundraisers and officials have been a little bit disgruntled at Senator Obama himself for not writing a check, $2,300, to which is the maximum allowed by law, to help wipe away some of the debt. And he has not urged his supporters that forcefully to contribute. But this week, he has changed that a little bit. He's had a conference call with members of his National Finance Committee. His fundraising officials are asking people. So I think they are helping out to a point. But look, Senator Obama said yesterday that he will not ask his list of supporters, some 1.5 million individual contributors, to lend a hand here. He said if they want to, you know, they're certainly able to, but he feels that this is you know, his community of donors, and he has a lot of money to raise himself. So the money remains one of the sticking points.
Mm. And what about Hillary Clinton's role in the presidential campaign? What issues are they trying to work out? You wrote this morning that even with tomorrow's joint appearance in Unity, they were working out details like will the Obama campaign fly her there and provide her with staff support?
Well, they'll definitely fly her tomorrow. The two senators are expected to fly together to New Hampshire. One of the issues of the plane is, as she campaigns for Senator Obama later in the year, will she have her own plane? Will she be allowed any staff to work for her? And these things are being worked through. She's basically being considered as the highest level surrogate possible. She is the highest level surrogate possible, along with her husband, former President Bill Clinton. So those are some of the details that are worked out. But she said that she will do whatever the Obama campaign would like her to do in the fall campaign. So if that means sending her to Ohio or to Pennsylvania or to Florida or to Michigan, she says she'll do it. And she has a little bit at stake here, too. She, you know, certainly received 18 million votes, as we all know, but she also, there were almost as many people who did not support her, especially in the African-American community. She's very interested in sort of repairing some of those wounds and hard feelings that were created over the last year and a half.
Well, you mentioned high-profile surrogates. What about the biggest, perhaps, or at least the sort of most potentially controversial unresolved question, and that is the role of her husband, Bill Clinton?
Well, the Clintons are really being treated as separate individuals in this whole merging process, if you will. And it must begin with Senator Clinton. She was the candidate. She was the rival to Senator Obama. So all the discussions so far have gone on individually with them. Former President Bill Clinton has not said anything, whether he supports Senator Obama, until this week. His office issued a brief statement. He's been traveling, but he is leaving this to Senator Clinton. But that is one of the open questions. How much will he be campaigning for Senator Obama? The Obama campaign, at least on its face, says, look, we'd like to have him campaign as much as possible. We would like to repair this. But I think that one is very much more a work in progress.
Well, it all sounds very complex. But on the other hand, don't all presidential campaigns have to go through this kind of negotiation to come together at this stage in the process? Or is there something remarkable about this particular situation?
I think this is very much typical to what's happened in previous years, 4 years ago, 8 years ago, 12 years ago, except the campaign went on for so long and it was so unclear which candidate was going to win. And the feelings really intensified over the last final 6 months of the campaign. So I think things are just magnified in this instance because of the celebrity status of the Clintons and Senator Obama and the fact that it went on so long. But look, you know, 2 months from now, we're not going to be discussing them coming together. You know, they'll move on.
That's Jeff Zeleny, political correspondent for the New York Times, talking about Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, who will campaign together tomorrow in Unity, New Hampshire. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, the week is winding down, and that means it's time to check in on the world of sports with Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, who joins us in the studio right now. Good to see you again, Bill.
Good to be here, Anthony.
So let's start with a subject near and dear to you, soccer. The European Championship down to its final matches. Germany beat Turkey yesterday on a last-minute goal by Philipp Lahm to advance to the finals. The Germans will face the winners of today's contest between Spain and Russia. They seem to be the team to beat. Can anyone stop them?
I think either Spain or Russia can stop Germany. I love the fact that Spain has hung in through the round where their jinx usually surfaces, which is the quarterfinal round. And the Russian team has looked extremely strong. So I think whichever of the Spain or Russia advances, it will be a very fine final. I don't think it's at all a foregone conclusion.
And remind us when the final is.
It'll be over the weekend.
Over the weekend. Okay, we'll keep an eye on that. Turning to basketball, the National Basketball Association holds its draft tonight. Point guard Derrick Rose is expected to go first to the Chicago Bulls. Then the question is whether the Miami Heat will go with power forward Michael Beasley or guard O.J. Mayo. The outcome could lead to a number of trades and reshuffling of the league. What's your take?
Well, the only significant trade that I've seen so far involved a shuffling of the 17th pick, and I'm not sure how important that actually will turn out to be. You know, what's most interesting to me at this point is, you know, whether Beasley and Rose go 1-2 or 2-1. And then after that, you know, who gets Jared Bayless, who gets Mayo. These are going to be intriguing things to watch.
Also, sticking with the NBA for a moment, what's this talk about Shaquille O'Neal losing his sheriff deputy's badges? You got to bring us up to date
on
this one.
Shaquille O'Neal has had a longstanding interest in law enforcement, and wherever he has played, from Miami to Phoenix to wherever, he has become a special deputy and sometimes ridden around in police cars with officers and that sort of thing. And unfortunately, the most recent faux pas committed by Shaquille was a rather rude, is there any other kind of, rap song in which he knocked former teammate Kobe Bryant. And several sheriffs have revoked his special deputy badges. So criminals, especially in the Southwest, may be rejoicing that one particularly large special deputy is no longer likely to be on their trail.
All right. Well, thanks for bringing us up to date on that one. Turning to golf, Tiger Woods undergoing knee surgery now. He underwent it successfully. He's out at least until the spring. So the spotlight turns to the women today at the 63rd U.S. Women's Open in Minnesota. Lorena Ochoa lost the Open in heartbreaking fashion in 2005, again in 2007, but she's been dominating the game of late. Has her time finally arrived?
Well, Anthony, in professional sports, they measure success in terms of dollars. I have before me the LPGA Tour Money Leaders List for 2008, and she has won a little over $2 million. Nobody else has won as much as $1.5 million. Annika Sorenstam, not surprisingly, is second. And yes, I think her time has come. I think the third time is going to be the charm. I wouldn't be a bit surprised if she won this major, as she has won several majors previous, and if we're seeing you know, the rise of really the next dominant female on the tour.
All right, we have time left for a little talk about baseball. Major League Baseball officials are talking with their counterparts from the Players Union to settle one of the sport's most pressing problems. And no, we're not talking about steroids. We're talking about this contentious issue, ash versus maple.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And we're talking about baseball bats here.
Yes, exactly. Well, a recent incident in which a maple bat shattered and an umpire was injured by a flying piece of maple baseball bat has brought up the concern that the maple bats are more likely to crack and shatter than the standard ash bats. If that does turn out to be the case, it's potentially a danger for anybody on the field and even some people sitting in the box seats quite close to the field, so they're going to have to work this one out.
And some people like these maple bats better because what the ball
travels farther. Well, the players say
farther.
The ball goes off them a little more quickly, travels a little further. Players are superstitious. I don't know whether anybody's actually proved that this is the case, but some of them say it is.
That's Bill Littlefield. He's host of NPR's weekly sports program, Only a Game. Thanks for coming in, Bill.
Thank you, Anthony.
Good to see you. Coming up, how does a musical standard become a standard? Stay with us. It's Here and Now. I'm Anthony Brooks. It's Here and Now. That's the late Luciano Pavarotti singing Nessun Dorma, one of opera's best-known arias. Every musical genre has them, the bona fide classics that have become part of our cultural consciousness. In jazz music, it's the song Round Midnight. In hip-hop, it's Rapper's Delight.
Now what you hear is not a test, I'm rapping to the beat. And me, the groove, and my friends are gonna try to move your feet.
But what makes a standard a standard? Here and Now's Christopher Blagg takes a look at the evolution of one song that's become a standard in the world of string band music.
String band music prides itself on tradition, on unearthing forgotten Appalachian fiddle tunes and dusty Piedmont ballads. Perhaps the most popular excavators of these classics today is an upstart group of 20-somethings from Nashville called the Old Crow Medicine Show. Their tune, Wagon Wheel, has taken on a life of its own.
Headed down south to the land of the pines, I'm thumbing my way to North Carolina, staring up the road and pray to God I see headlights. I made it down the coast in 17 hours, picking me a bouquet of dogwood flowers, and I'm hoping for Raleigh I can see my baby tonight. So rock me, mama, like a wagon wheel. Rock me, mama, any way you feel. Hey, mama, rock me.
Wagon Wheel is quickly becoming a string band standard. And if you play in a string band, it behooves you to learn it. It will be requested. Boston-based old-time musician Greg Glassman has an idea why.
I mean, it's the perfect pop chorus. You've got old-timey verses mixed with a chorus that just screams, rock me mama like a wagon wheel. I mean, who doesn't want to sing that with 20 or 30 of their good friends gathered around for a good time?
Running from the cold up in New England, I was born to be a fiddler in an old-time string band. My baby plays a guitar, a big banjo now.
Many standards have a backstory, a tale that lends legend and mystique, and Wagon Wheel's journey is an epic one. The song's co-writer, Old Crow Medicine Show's Ketch Secor, was 17 when he heard a rare Bob Dylan bootleg, an outtake off the 1972 Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid soundtrack. Rock Me Mama was a fragment, no verses, just a breezy chorus. Secor became obsessed with the tune's warmth, its anthemic quality, so he wrote verses to go along with Dylan's chorus and renamed it Wagon Wheel.
It's sort of like saving a ship that's going down. It's like a preservation, the act of saving a sinking song for the posterity of future generations.
Secor hammered out a publishing deal with Dylan to get co-writing credit on Wagon Wheel and uncovered a gem. He learned that Dylan's version had been inspired by Memphis bluesman Arthur Big Boy Crudup's Rock Me Baby in the 50s.
Now, rock me mama.
So Secor kept digging and discovered that Crudup credits the song to Big Bill Brunzi, a blues singer from the 20s.
That's when I realized that the song was going to last because it wasn't just my idea or my song, and it wasn't even just Bob's song, and it wasn't even Arthur Crudup's song or Big Bill Brunzi's song, that it was somehow the four of us had written this song for everybody.
Soon after the Old Crow Medicine Show released Wagon Wheel in 2004, the song caught fire with pickers and fiddlers all over the country, and it's become a standard the old-fashioned way, by people playing it every night in bars and at campfire picking parties. It hasn't been covered by major pop artists, so Secor isn't making any publishing money on the song. That's okay with him.
I mean, I would be excited if, like, Beyonce wanted to record Wagon Wheel. That'd be awesome. But for some reason, it's 10 times more thrilling when I get a phone call from somebody who's like playing me some garbled message on their cell phone in some bar in Colorado or Kentucky, hey, they're playing your song at the bar, man. And then they'll put the phone up and you'll hear some garbled wagon wheel. And that happens to me all the time. I get that message.
One of the prerequisites for any standard is the ability to cross genres. And it's not just bearded string band devotees who love Wagon Wheel. The song's universal themes of restlessness and the road, of the mythic South, of longing and lust connect with all kinds of folks.
There's also a youthfulness in the song because here's this kid and he's breaking out. And that's what's so autobiographical about it. My senior year of high school, I'm in this prep school, and I got to get out, man. I got to get down south. I had this gig lined up in North Carolina, and that's what the song's alluding to, is this show. So, you know, it's all very true to life.
Walking due south out of Roanoke, I caught a trucker out of Philly, had a nice long toque. But he's headed west from the Cumberland Gap to Johnson City, Tennessee. And I gotta get a move on before the sun. I hear my baby calling my name, and I know that she's the only one. And if I die in Raleigh, at least I will die free.
So Wagon Wheel's popularity has produced the inevitable backlash, especially among hardcore veteran musicians. It's gotten where some make it a point to not play the song. I caught up with string band player Sean Staples at a Boston area pub just before a performance. He says he has mixed feelings about Wagon Wheel.
It is a great song, but the problem is that when you get people coming in and they see you playing with a banjo player, and that's all they know of banjo music, quote unquote, and they ask for that song, it's like it gets to a point where it's like it's ridiculous. It is over the top. You know, you get that request a million times, and you start feeling like there's inevitably this backlash of like, well, the hell with that song. Especially if you've been doing it for a while and you know that there's such a deeper well to draw from.
Yeah, that's Staples singing Wagon Wheel. He included the song in his band set that night after all. Wagon Wheel, it seems, is a hard habit to break. I mean, if you believe the story, the song has lasted over 85 years already. And listening to Secor tell its history makes you wonder. Maybe all great songs are already out there, just waiting for the right songwriter to grab it out of the ether, to make it come alive.
The language that the songwriter uses is much older than himself and his years. It's a collective memory. We're able to draw off this common ground, all of us that write song. There's this wellspring, you know, we go fill our jug up at the source. It doesn't belong to any one person.
Headed down south to the land of the pines, I'm thumbing my way to North Carolina, staring up the road and pray to God I see headlights.
Our story on the evolution of a standard was produced by Christopher Blagg. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Please join us again here and now.
Running from the cold up in New England, I was born to be a fiddler in an old-time string band. My baby plays a guitar, a big banjo now. Country winners keep forgetting me, and I lost my money playing poker, so I had to wipe and lay, but I ain't turning back to live that old life no more. So rock me, mama, like a wagon wheel. Rock me, mama, any way you feel.